Welcome to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. I'm Maeve Conran, the coalition's managing editor, and today, April is National Poetry Month, and we'll hear some cowboy poetry.
You be the judge and jury now. This little ditty's done. Are we better off today than before the West was won?
Then, efforts to diversify snow sports.
There are so many different people riding with us, like all body types, like all different colors of people, all different cultures.
A quilting workshop brings people together in Southwest Colorado.
And this place was on a list of some quilters' favorite quilting workshop places.
And an environmental historian explores borders, plants, and belonging.
Our own stories of migration are also the stories of these plants. We've taken them with us, usually.
From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it's the Regional Roundup. April is National Poetry Month, and to celebrate, we're bringing you some poetry that's an integral part of the Rocky Mountain West. Cowboy poetry. From KGNU's From the Archives to the Air, we'll hear now some cowboy poetry recorded in 1990. Here's Jackie Sedley.
Cowboy poetry has been called a blend of Irish storytelling, Scottish seafaring, and cattle tending. The Poets.org website says the particulars of cowboy poetry derive from the American West. Horses, cattle, prairie storms, mythic figures of cowboys and ranchers, and the great outdoors, delivered in styles ranging from the sublime to the silly.
Well, old Lefty died a cowboy, the only life he ever knew. And he left all he had to his loving wife, though his possessions numbered few. But his will contained the strangest thing that the lawyer ever read, 'cause when they opened his last testament, this is what it said. Now, honey, when I die, y'all skin me out, go ahead and tan my hide. Make me into a saddle so I'll be there for you to ride. Then I'll always be right in between the two things that I love, with my horse running down below me and my woman up above. Now don't take me to be crazy, I still control my faculties.
Words and Wisdom of the West was recorded live by KGNU at the Colorado Cowboy Poetry Gathering at the Arvada Center for the Arts and Humanities on January 12th and 13th of 1990.
Now, honey, when I die, y'all skin me out, go ahead and tan my hide. Make me into a saddle, so I'll be there for you to ride. Then I'll always be right in between two things that I love, with my horse run down below me and my woman up above. Thank you.
We're dancing to a faster tune than we did in bygone days. Say, great-grandma did return, do you suppose she'd want to stay? Would she think life is better than a horse and buggy age? Or think we had progressed ourselves, plumb off the end of the page? We are Jane Fonda exercised and by Bog Juan Garud. We're PTL evangelized and Madison Avenued. Hug your kids, your cat, your dog. Get suntanned by a machine. We're superstarred by a frog. We're even laser beamed. We're microwaved, electric shaved, and low cholesteroled. Prefabbed, homed, and styrofoamed. Buzzed, beeped, and car phone called. We're shrink-wrapped and wiretapped and foreign compact card. We're delayed, stressed, and permanent pressed. We're constantly VCR'd. We're paper-shredded, water-bedded, by Jim and Tammy hypnotized. We know where disaster's headed, seen through colored contact eyes. Read my lips, microchips, belted steel and iron pumped. We fill a barge with garbage and then can't get it dumped. We're faxed, machined, and jelly-beaned. We've tattooed ladies by the dozens. We are think-tanked and sperm-banked, and love is something from the oven. Elect a prez from TV ratings. Get facelifted in a jar. What's more, computers do our dating. Tell us what sign you are. Our fingers do the walking. We dial a prayer or porn. Watch TV on Sunday morning and get instantly reborn. Microfished and satellite dished, charge carded and jet lagged. Streets are the only home to the ladies we call bagged. We're astroturfed and purple smurfed. We get our food freeze-dried. We're Asian flued and superglued. What's become of cowboy pride? You be the judge and jury now. This little ditty's done. Are we better off today than before the West was won?
They called him Pert Near Perkins, for unless the booger lied, he'd Pert Near done most everything that he had ever tried. He'd Pert Near been a preacher, and he'd Pert Near roped a bear, and he met up with Comanches once, and Pert Near lost his hair. He'd Pert Near wed an heiress that had money by the keg, and he'd Pert Near caught the measles, and he'd Pert Near broke his leg. He'd Pert Near been a trail boss, and according to his claim, he'd Pert Near shot Bill Hickok, which had Pert Near won him fame. He'd Pert Near rode some broncs upon which no one else had stuck. In fact, he was the feller who had Pert Near drowned the duck. Now, mostly all the cowboys on the lazy SB spread, they took his talking with a grin and let him fight his head. But one named Tom McGinnis sort of told it to him rough. You're riding with an outfit now where Pert Near ain't enough. We tie our last ropes to our horns, and what we catch we hold, and Pert Near's one alibi we never do unfold. In fact, right now I'll tell you that no words I ever hear sound quite so plain dang useless as that little pair, Pert Near. Now that's how Tom McGinnis laid it out upon the line, and like a heap of preaching talk, it sounded mighty fine. But one day Tom McGinnis, while riding off alone, he lamed his hoss and had to catch some neighbor Nestor's roan to ride back to the ranch on. But somewhere along the way, them Nestors held him up, and there was the devil to pay. Tom claimed he hadn't stole the hoss, just borrowed it to ride. Them Nestors hated cowboys. They told him that he lied. They cussed him for a hoss thief, and they caught him with the goods, and they set right out to hang him in a nearby patch of woods. They had poor Tom surrounded with some guns all fixed to shoot, and it sure looked like this cowboy had heard his last owl hoot. They tied a rope around his neck, and they throwed it over a limb, till Tom McGinnis, Pert Near, knowed this was the last of him. Then suddenly a shot rang out from somewhere up the hill. Them Nestors dropped the rope and ran like fellers often will when bullets get to whizzing. Tom's heart leapt up with a hope to see old Pert Near Perkins riding towards him at a lope. Looks like I Pert Near got here just in time, old Perkins said, to see them Nestors hang you. Tom's face got kind of red. You Pert Near did, he Pert Near grinned. They Pert Near had me strung. You're looking at a cowboy that has Pert Near just been hung, and also one who's changed his mind for no words ever said can sound as sweet as Pert Near when a man's been Pert Near dead. Thank you.
Words and Wisdom of the West was recorded and produced by the KGNU Cowboy Poetry Committee. Mike and Mouse Bradshaw, Jane Carpenter, Hartha Raskowski, Paul Metters, Scott Schlegel, Mike Keller, Marty Derlin, Mike Bell, and Susan Roraba. You've been listening to From the Archives to the Air. This program is written and produced by John Kellen with the assistance of Alexis Kenyon. I'm Jackie Sedley. Thanks for listening.
That selection of cowboy poetry was recorded by KGNU at the Words and Wisdom of the West event at the Colorado Cowboy Poetry Gathering that took place in January 1990. And that show was from the KGNU's From the Archives to the Air special. And you can catch the entire thing at kgnu.org. The snow sports industry is disproportionately white, and according to last winter's data from ski areas across the country, only 1.5% of the surveyed resort guests were black. But you'd never guess those numbers if you went to Elk Camp at Snowmass near Aspen, Colorado recently Aspen Public Radio's Kaya Williams stopped by the Burton Culture Shifters event, which is focused on welcoming more people of colour to the slopes.
It's practically t-shirt weather at the Elk Camp Meadows Learning Area. And snowboarder Zeb Powell, an X Games gold medalist in the knuckle huck, is giving some pointers to a tall, athletic woman who's borrowed a name from another X Games star.
Shauna White is back in full effect. And last year I was able to do a 180, I learned in the first day. This year I'm gonna try to do a 360, so I'm excited.
Her given name is Christina Granville. She used to play semi-pro basketball, now works in sports media. Granville came to Culture Shifters for the first time last year to experience something she'd never tried before.
I'm from Atlanta, and I've never been snowboarding in my entire life, never had the idea to go snowboarding because I always said, well, black people don't snowboard.
Granville says it's a pretty common misconception. People figure, it's cold, it's far to travel, there's a lot of barriers to entry. This week, she's one of more than 80 participants. Almost all of them are Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. And when she posted about her experience on social media last year, she got a lot of enthusiastic responses.
She was like, girl, I gotta try this. I wanna come with you next year. When is this? When is Culture Shifters again? Can I come? How do I get involved? Even different companies are like, okay, what is this that you're doing? How do I get involved? How do I be a part of it?
This kind of reaction and the ripple effect of it makes Zeb Powell feel pretty good about what he's doing here.
I think the biggest thing is seeing is believing, and that's what we're doing. Just get the crew together and the rest will do the work.
Powell is one of the visionaries behind this event, along with sports commentator Salema Masekela from the X Games. This all started 4 years ago when Team Burton invited hip-hop artist ASAP Ferg to Snowmass for some lessons. They figured it could help change perceptions of snowboarding. Because if people could see a rapper from Harlem having fun on the bunny hill, it might encourage other folks of color to try snowboarding too. Since then, the Culture Shifters event has basically quadrupled in size. There's a mix of athletes, influencers, advocates, and creatives, all pretty diverse in their identities and backgrounds.
There are so many different people riding with us, like all body types, like all different colors of people, all different cultures.
Ashley Laporte is the Vice President of Purpose and Impact at Burton. Her job is focused on using the company's power and influence to affect bigger picture change. Laporte says this event is all-inclusive, so participants don't have to worry about the cost of travel or whether they'll have the right equipment. She believes people of color shouldn't just feel like they could snowboard, but that they're actually part of the mountain culture when they hit the slopes.
We stand out, but as a collective, it's hard to explain. You just feel like you belong, and we're not sticking out. It's really nice.
Salema Masekela says that visibility and community is a really big deal for snow sports.
You don't know what you're missing sometimes until you have it. You know, I love snowboarding. It's given me so much over the course of the last 3 decades. But I rarely got to share it with people who have a similar experience as me.
Masekela talks a lot about being the only, as in the only black guy on the mountain. That is until now, at events like Culture Shifters.
Just to look around at any given time on the mountain and be like, hey, that's another person who looks like me, and look at how much fun they're having and the joy they're having in the outdoors. It's magic.
Masekela says there's still a long way to go to make the mountains more colorful. Other folks at Culture Shifters talk about the importance of diversity in snow sports corporations, too. And they say that while some companies are making strides forward, others are shrinking away from the idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion because it's turned into a political buzzword. Even so, Masekela says the culture is changing. For him, this work isn't just important because snowboarding is fun.
It's how I tap into the totality of my being. You know, I get to feel, am I most awake and most alive?
Culture Shifters wrapped up yesterday after several sunny days of snowboarding, parties, and fireside chats. The program also involved several nonprofits who focus on race, equity, and inclusion in the outdoors year-round. From the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk, I'm Kaya Williams.
And you can see photos from the Culture Shifters event at aspenpublicradio.org. You're listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. I'm Maeve Conran. Each spring, a week-long quilt workshop takes over the Gateway Resort along a remote stretch of the Dolores River in Colorado's Canyon Country. KOTO's Gavin McGough spent a day with the quilters and brings us this audio postcard.
Okay, so I think this is winner of best of show. Okay. Yeah. Now, first place.
In a courtyard of the grand hacienda-style Gateway Resort, way out in the canyon country of Mesa County, a group of women have gathered to vote on the ugliest quilt.
Well, right here. I think right here, first place.
The quilts spread on the lawn are small, the size of a large doormat, and they are indeed ugly, or at least garish, clashing, slapdash. But that's the point of this particular session at the Allegre Quilting Retreat, explained instructor and art quilter Sue Benner.
In a lot of my classes, when I teach layered collage, they do the background, because I want three layers, they do the background, and they don't want to cover it up because they think it's so beautiful. So I'm purposely having them do something that they don't think is beautiful so that they can cover almost all of it up, and they're not going to mind doing that.
Over the next few days, Benner's students will work to collage over their quote-unquote ugly quilts and come out with something intuitive, surprising, and perhaps beautiful. Benner is an accomplished and widely exhibited quilt artist. Today, she presides over a classroom piled high with fabric, irons pumping out steam, and women stooped over their piecing. Each year, at the cusp of spring, quilters from across the country descend on this resort in a distant eddy of Colorado's Red Rock Canyons to enjoy off-season prices and devote themselves to studying with some of the biggest names in the art quilting world. Many here are experienced quilters, but not all. Tina Ray is 23. How did she come to Allegre?
Well, I was trying to figure out how to learn how to quilt because, you know, there's not a lot of places to learn it. And so I ended up searching for workshops, places where like everybody would gather together so I could, through osmosis, absorb everybody's wonderful knowledge. And this place was on a list of some quilters' favorite quilting workshop places.
Participants at the week-long retreat sign up for a single intensive course. The day is broken by lunch with a lecture to follow. And for anyone seeking inspiration, trails and pathways beckon, leading up from the resort into the scrubby footlands above the Dolores River. The question of what exactly is an art quilt floats in the air. Delivering a lunch lecture, quilter Lisa Ellis addresses the divisions between craft, fine art, tradition, and modernism.
These categorizations make me crazy. Studio Art Club Associates, our definition is if it's original, if it's from your head, then it's art. This idea that, well, you know, it's block-based. No, there's nothing that says you can't make something that's block-based and that it's therefore traditional and not worthy.
Many attendees bring finished work to share. Hanging in the dining room, it makes a collection as diverse and wonderful as can be imagined. Terry Mangett of Taos has taught at Allegre in the past, but this year she's simply attending.
The lady that inspired me to make quilts was Mrs. Earl Clay in Carlisle, Kentucky. I got a degree in art from the University of Kentucky, and then my friend introduced me to her, and she made all these wacky quilts. She lived near a men's underwear factory, and she would just make these quilts, but she used these wacky fabrics from the men's underwear factory. And the fact that she put these weird fabrics together made me want to make quilts.
Ms. Earl Clay, back in Kentucky, worked without a sewing machine, hand-stitching every piece. Says Mangat, for decades, she turned to modern technology.
I thought, well, I would never have the patience to hand-quilt. But now I'm like 76 years old, and I find that I love to hand stitch every evening, and my work is now mostly hand-pieced.
The process of working without a machine is extremely time-consuming, but can produce a different sort of product, less polished, certainly, organic. Attendee Barbara Pevney, meanwhile, got into quilting with a close friend after retirement.
When I stopped being in private practice with her as a counselor, I told her, I need to still see you every week. So I went and started quilting with her in her river home on the Animas.
Pevney, who briefly came out of retirement in order to pay the Allegre tuition bill, lived for years in Durango, Colorado, before moving to Fort Collins. To be back in this Western Slope country for such study and practice, Pevney is speechless.
I have no words. You can bring me to tears. I'm a Red Rock girl, and I love the Red Rock, and it's just stunning. Totally stunning here.
Outside, sun mixes with wind and bird song. There's just a hint of new growth on the overwintering trees, and the day is quiet, almost sacred beneath the soaring mesa cliffs. But if you listen through open classroom doors, you can hear the Allegre quilters as they set into their afternoon.
And we round out today's show with environmental historian Jessica Lee, who explores borders, plants, and belonging in her new collection of essays. Lee spoke about her new book, Dispersals, with Taya J on KVNF's show, The Pen and the Sword.
Well, I think on some level, metaphor was the beginning stage for this book, right? Because I started with this idea of plants out of place. And of course, you know, there are literal displacements that I write about, but then there's also that metaphorical one, that idea of, okay, when you shift something out of its culture, you know, when you frame something differently, there are different meanings assigned. And I think in that comparison between the language of plants and the language of people, you know, I didn't want to hit that too hard, but it was a really insistent parallel. You know, I kept thinking there's an essay or a chapter in Richard Mabie's book, Weeds, where he sort of says outright, it would be a bit crass to fully just say that, you know, the way we talk about weeds is the same way we talk about people, that, you know, they are different things and they do have different stories. But for me, I sort of took that and I said, well, wait a second, let me unpack that a little bit more, because the metaphors we use, the language we use to describe migrants, unwanted people, mixed race people, all sorts of things often feel very insistently parallel to the language used in this kind of conservation science when we're speaking about invasive species and when we speak about eradication. And so I really wanted to sort of sit with that a little bit further and just figure out what kind of stories would unfold.
A recurring reminder in the collection for me is the importance of language. And I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about language and why it matters.
There's a chapter in the book that's called Dispersals, which is also in the name of the whole book. And this chapter for me was this moment where I really wanted to unpack for myself the history of a lot of the terminology we have for plants out of place. So, you know, the words native, non-native, invasive. I really wanted to understand where those came from, because they weren't always in use, why they're so powerful and why they are so debated, why they're so like contentiously debated still, and whether there were other alternatives. So being a historian, I turned to the archives, I turned to history, and just started unpacking for myself some of the earliest examples we have of language for classifying belonging in plants. And one of the really fascinating examples I came across, which I think really, it just illustrated my point for me very, very well, was that one of the earliest from the mid-19th century in the UK, Hewitt Cottrell Watson, he came up with these terms for whether or not plants belonged, and he assigned them to different countries in the UK, and he borrowed his terminology from citizenship law. He had been apprenticed as a lawyer before that, And it made sense to him that when we described plants as either belonging or not belonging, we could use the same language that we use for people. And that, for me, was a pretty resonant point to dwell on in terms of how we've inherited the language we've got and how we might think about the limitations of that going forward. Yeah, so I wanted to unpack that. I wanted to look at, you know, a lot of the existing debates into language, not in a way that questions whether or not there's validity to, say, you know, critiquing the problem of invasive species, critiquing the ecological damage they do. That's not a question in the book. The question is more, can we come up with a better framework for describing this that is less exclusionary? Are there other alternatives? And increasingly, one of the questions I have is, does this language prevent us from seeing forms of resilience, positive impacts, all sorts of other ways that these plants might interact with our worlds?
We live here in an agricultural valley, and we grow a lot of stone fruit. And, you know, while I was reading the book, I was thinking about how much of our cultural identity is informed by the fact that we grow fruit, you know, in particular the peach. We refer to it as the Paonia peach, which is the town that we live in. And there's, you know, so much pride in the fruit that we produce. It's our reputation. It's our livelihood for some people. But of course, It has me thinking about at what point does something, you know, of course the peach came from somewhere else. Stone fruit came from somewhere else. And it has me thinking about, you know, at what point does something become naturalized and what determines that? Is it the amount of time that the plants are on the land? Is it the cultural identity that the plants seem to inform? How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, there's the sort of factual answer, which is that, you know, it depends. It depends on the context very often, right? Human intervention is often seen as the big deciding factor in whether a plant belongs or not. And then things like, you know, does that plant behave in a way that we want it to? Does it try to escape cultivation all the time? Is it having detrimental economic impacts? And of course, those are kind of shifting values, right? It's so contextual. So it's something that I think is really fascinating. And for me, I think less thinking about, okay, how we botanically classify, you know, whether or not a species belongs, what's more interesting is that exactly what you described, the idea that this fruit is kind of the pride of your community, right? That it has mm-hmm. this really emotional resonance for huge numbers of people. That for me is the story that I think is really compelling, because so many of us will connect with that idea of being out of place. And having, I think, that opportunity to connect with the plant, I hope this doesn't sound too wishy-washy, but to connect with a plant sort of on those same terms, I think is a really amazing invitation for kinship with the natural world, for connection with the natural world, for really understanding that our own stories of migration are also the stories of these plants. We've taken them with us usually. And that, you know, if we really want to understand our own belonging, our own place, we need to ask the same of the plants we've brought with us.
That was environmental historian Jessica Lee speaking about her new collection of essays, Dispersal, with KVNF's Taya Jay, on the pen and the sword. And you can catch the entire show at kvnf.org. You've been listening to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. Thanks to KGNU, Aspen Public Radio, KOTO, and KVNF for today's show. Our theme music is Take Me Somewhere by Joel Adam Russell. I'm Maeve Conran. Thanks for listening.